We are looking at five women that are found in the genealogy of Jesus, and this one that we have today is Ruth. Let me apologize for my voice. Still at the tail end of something that appears this time of year. I want to talk to you about Ruth, and you have before you the very end of the story of Ruth, from verse 18 down to 21 or 20 or 22. These are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Aminadab. Aminadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. Of course, this genealogy is following the male descendancy through Boaz to David. And of course, you all know that Boaz was Ruth's husband, so that makes Boaz the grandfather, the great grandfather of David, the grandfather of Jesse, which makes Ruth, of course, the great grandmother of David. And it seems all very appropriate that since tomorrow you're all meeting together with mothers and sons and grandparents and perhaps great-grandchildren running around looking for some pumpkin pie tomorrow, that we're considering together a genealogy in the life of Jesus. And of course, just in case you hadn't made the connection, that David, of course, that lineage goes all the way down to Jesus. So Ruth. The book of Ruth, it comes immediately after the book of Judges. And anyone who's been to Sunday school will know that the book of Judges tells us that it's a period of time when everyone did that which was right in their own eyes. So it's in this, following this period of declension in the history of God's redemptive people. We have this little cameo, this wonderful little book, greatest short story ever told, the book of Ruth. Three words summarize the book of Ruth as we focus on Ruth herself. Firstly, the word ruin. Secondly, the word resolve. And thirdly, the word redemption. So that's my trajectory to tell the story of Ruth, beginning with the word ruin. Now, you remember the story. We're introduced to a young couple, Elimelech and Naomi. And they have two boys. They may well be, it's hard to know, they may well be 7 or 8 years of age by this time. And their names are Mahlon and Chilion. And there's a famine in the land. They live in Bethlehem. Oh, do I need to tell you the significance of Bethlehem? No, I don't. They live in Bethlehem. Of course, Bethlehem at this point in the history of Israel is nothing. It's nowhere. It's just a little town, a little village. Jerusalem is nothing. It isn't even on the map yet. It's not even called Jerusalem. And it's not yet the city of David and the significant place that it will be. And certainly Bethlehem isn't. But of course, in God's redemptive purposes, Bethlehem will become one of the most significant little towns in all of the world. But you have Naomi and Elimelech, Mahlon and Chilion. A little family with two little boys, and there's a famine in Israel. We're not told the reason for the famine. There's a little hint, because of the period of history that we're living in, that this may be a judgment of God. One of the things God had said in establishing a covenant, that if they departed from his ways, one of the things that might occur is a famine. And there's a famine in the land. Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, future mother-in-law, Naomi and Elimelech, Mahlon and Chilion make their way to Moab. You know, going to Moab was like going to the other side. If you're Gamecock fans, it would be like going to Clemson, I suppose, or vice versa. It was going over to the enemy. You know, Moab was outside of the people of God. It was outside of the covenant purposes of God. The Moabites worshipped a different god. Actually, they worshipped several gods. And they were into all kinds of things like child sacrifice and so on. It says something. It says something perhaps about the extent of the famine, or it might even say something about the extent of Elimelech's backsliding, possibly. That they were prepared to go to a place where the promises of God were no longer effective. They go to the Moabites. And worse happens. You know, if your young boys go off to another part of the world, don't be surprised if they marry pretty girls from that part of the world. But it's not just marrying pretty girls. Mahlon marries Ruth, and Chilion marries Orpah, and Orpah. Well, let me elaborate a little on the story here. We know the end of the story. You know, you go to Barnes & Noble or Books A Million and you sit down. I don't know how Barnes & Noble make money, to be honest. Because everyone reads the books and then puts them back on the shelves and no one seems to buy anything. I just don't know how it works. You know, maybe you've read the end of this story. You know this story ends wonderfully because it ends with Jesus, right? But I want you to try and put yourself back into the time period. And it could have been disaster. It could have been an absolute disaster that Mahlon and Chilion marry outside of the faith. Basically, they marry Moabitesses. They marry Moabitesses with all of the consequences of that. Bringing into the marriage idols and goodness knows what. It's a story with a tragedy. It's an absolute heart-wrenching story, because no sooner have they gone to Moab and the two boys have married these two Moabitesses than Elimelech dies. Naomi loses her husband, and then within a space of perhaps a few years, it isn't all that clear how long a period of time, but within a short period of time, she loses her two sons. It's a tragedy. It's a devastating tragedy. She's left alone with two daughters-in-law, and she's lost the three most important people in her life, her husband and her two sons. It's a tragedy. It's a heart-wrenching tragedy. And Naomi goes home to Bethlehem because she's a widow. She's a widow in a foreign country. There's no food stamps. There's no Obamacare. There's nothing. There's absolutely nothing for her. The only prospect for her is back in Bethlehem with her people. To seek the help and benevolence, kindness of her people. And there's a turning point in the story. You remember it well. They're at a point, a crossroads from Moab to Bethlehem, and it's a point where Orpah, the one with bad eyes, Orpah leaves. She decides to go. She goes back to her people, to the Moabites, where she's from. But Ruth does not go. Now remember, this is first of all a story about ruin. It's a story about providence. It's a story about hardship and difficulty. And Ruth has lost her husband, her newlywed husband. She has no children, so we don't know how long this marriage had been. Maybe it was just months. Maybe it was just a brief marriage, a wonderful love affair for her, and she married this boy called Mahlon. He was probably in his teens, and he's dead. He's gone. Tragedy. Bad things happen. Terrible things happen. Why do bad things happen? Why do bad things happen in the way that they do? And some of you can enter into this story all too well. You've had your share of trials and difficulties, and there are dark moments in your life that you can relate to. And Ruth, let's get to the resolve part of the story, shall we? Let's turn the page of ruin. Because God is in this story. God's sovereignty is in this story. And Ruth makes a resolve. You remember the words that she says at the crossroads? Wherever you go, I will go. Don't ask me to leave you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. It's language. You understand, it's language that's loaded with significance. You know, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. Actually, in the very expressions that she uses, these are phrases that you can find in the Pentateuch, in the books of Moses. So Ruth has heard about the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. She's heard about Naomi's God. And where did she hear this from? Well, maybe from her husband Mahlon, but more likely, I think, from Naomi, from her mother-in-law. Now, I have my share of mother-in-law jokes. I could share them with you. I had a wonderful mother-in-law. She was wonderful. She was very kind to me. I couldn't have asked for a better one. She's gone now, but I think of her with very fond memories. Miss her. Miss her mince pies, for sure. She would bake things for me on a weekly basis and send them home when I would visit on a Sunday afternoon. And a wonderful mother-in-law. Who loved the Lord and loved to sing hymns especially, and have wonderful memories of her. But Naomi has, you understand, Naomi has evangelized Ruth. She's spoken the gospel to Ruth. You know, what Ruth is saying, in effect, is, you know, whatever it is that you've got, I want. Whatever it is that fills your life with contentment and in the midst of tragedy, you know, she'd watched Naomi cope with terrible tragedy, the loss of a husband and two children. She'd watched that. She'd seen in her something that made her say to herself, whatever it is you've got, I want. Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Now you understand that for a Moabitess like Ruth to come back to Bethlehem was going to be difficult. She was a foreigner. And do I need to spell this out? You know, people can treat foreigners badly. You know, you're not one of us. You're not from here. You're not one of our people. You don't understand our ways. You don't understand our customs. Now, it's a mark, I think, of the degree of Ruth's commitment, her resolve, that she would say with absolutely no guarantees whatsoever, no guarantees, where you go, I will go. There's something about you and there's something about your people that I implicitly trust. And there's something about your God that I implicitly trust. She's put her faith in Naomi's God, in the God of Israel, the only God there is. Ruth has been converted. She's been converted in the midst of tragedy and trial and difficulty. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. And out of trial, out of difficulty, you know, grace grows best in winter. Parsnips. Do you know what parsnips are? You've seen them in the, you know, in the grocery. You pass them by, you think, whoever eats those things? Well, we do. And parsnips are best. They're terrible here in South Carolina. They're awful. They're bad. They don't taste good at all. Because parsnips need frost. At least that's what my mother said. And when they get frozen in the ground and then you pull them up, because they're a winter crop, and you pull them up out of a frosty ground, they have a different, something chemical occurs when they freeze, and they have an entirely different taste. They're not as stringy as the parsnips here. Anyway, enough about parsnips. That was my Thanksgiving recipe offering. But my point is that grace grows best in winter. And you see it in Naomi, and you see it in Ruth, and you see it in her resolve to go back to Bethlehem. Well, you know what happens when she gets back to Bethlehem. Redemption. Redemption, because she meets a man that she would never have dreamed of meeting. She's a widow. Right? She's a widow. She's a foreigner. She's a Moabitess. And she finds herself doing what folk like her would have to do. She was poor. She had no means to survive. So she goes gleaning. One of the laws in Israel was that you didn't harvest the whole crop. You left bits on the side and in the corners of the field for the poor to come in and glean. And she was there from morning until night. And one of Boaz's workmen says of her in the second chapter that she was diligent. She was industrious. And she didn't complain. She saw it as one of God's great gifts to her. There's a love story that develops in chapter 2. Boaz, Boaz sees her, notices her. She's a pretty young girl. And you can see this blossoming romance. It's a wonderful story. If you haven't read Ruth recently, go back and read it. You can see how when Boaz asks about her and find out some information, who is this woman? He's noticed her. He's seen her. And Naomi has seen that Boaz has seen her too. And Naomi, you see, you know, it's possible to run ahead of the providence of God. You understand that? You can run ahead of God's providence. You can see, at least you think you can see what God is doing, and then you can make sure that he does it. And Naomi sees the answer. You have to understand, she's a mother-in-law. She wants the best for her daughter-in-law, her late son's wife. And the best thing that could ever happen to a widow in this period of history would be to get married. Because otherwise there was no provision for her. And Boaz is a kinsman redeemer. He's a goel in Hebrew. And that, and you know, that means a whole lot. That means he comes with attachments and money and provision and security and the future. You see, he's under some kind of obligation according to Old Testament Levirate law. Because she is a relative of an in-law to Boaz. Boaz is related to Naomi, and he's obligated. He's under some kind of obligation, which is a good thing as far as Naomi is concerned. Now, it's even better that Boaz actually likes the girl. That's even better. But that it could always go wrong. This act of redemption, it could always go wrong. You know, he could turn her down. He would be a social pariah if he did so, but he could do that. And it was done. He could, there's another kinsman redeemer in the making. There's somebody nearer than Boaz in the story. The story gets a little convoluted. It gets a little tense. So what does Naomi do? Do you remember what she does in the one evening after threshing? And the men are, well, how can I put it? They're more than a little thankful. They've tasted the fruits of their labors, and they're merry. You know, when you sing "God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen," you know, it doesn't mean what you think it means. We're going to look at that in December. Merry didn't mean what you think it means. But these men were merry. It's midnight. And Naomi says to her daughter-in-law, you know, put on midnight allure, the perfume, and go at midnight and make yourself known to Boaz. She has lost her mind. You know, I don't care what contextualization you engage in. You know, there were different times from ours, but you wouldn't send your daughter out wearing midnight allure at midnight to a possible suitor. Not unless 20 brothers were there as chaperones. But of course, this was tantamount to a proposal of marriage. Now, normally the proposal of marriage would come from Boaz, but Naomi wants to make sure that this marriage takes place. So she puts Ruth in the position of proposing marriage to Boaz. That's what the story is really about. Yes, despite Naomi's folly, and folly is the kindest word for it. And you understand Naomi. You have to sympathize with her. If you're a mother, you can sympathize with Naomi. But it could all have gone terribly wrong. And it says something about the dignity of Boaz that the story ends without a hint of impropriety. Not a hint of impropriety. It could have gone terribly wrong. And Boaz... you know, Boaz marries her. He does his duty. But he doesn't just do his duty. He does it because he evidently loves her. And there's something about Boaz that makes a wonderful example, I think, of a suitor. He's a wonderful husband. I think he's a model husband in his dealings here in the story. But it says something too about Ruth. Ruth emerges in this story as a woman of incredible godliness. A woman who's not even a Jew. She's a Moabitess who's been converted. She's a proselyte. She's come into the faith. But she's a wonderful, wonderful example of godliness. And they marry. And... let me pick up the story in verse 13 of chapter 4. Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. He went into her. The Lord gave her conception. She bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. May his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child, laid him on her lap, and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi," technically a grandson, of course. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David, the father of, the father of, the father of Jesus. Who would have thought? Who would have thought in this story, this wonderful love story in Ruth, who would have thought that God was working out not just his blessing to this particular little family, this nobody of a family, from a nothing place called Bethlehem, that God was working out his sovereign plan and purpose, that Bethlehem would once again be at the center of the world's stage and history in the birth of another little boy called Jesus to Mary. In the lineage of Jesus, there is a woman called Ruth, a godly woman, but she was a Moabitess. She was outside of the covenant line, and she was grafted in by the mercy and grace of God. Well, as we approach the Christmas season, what a wonderful story. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. However dark the trial may be, God may be working in that trial a providence that you may not see, and your children may not see, and maybe your great grandchildren may not see, and it may be for the purposes of your great, great, great grandchildren. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Father, we thank you. Thank you for your word. Thank you that it is able to make us wise unto salvation. Thank you for the story of Jesus through these Old Testament narratives. Thank you for Ruth, and pray that we might trust you in the darkness of certain providences in our own lives, that we might trust you for what is to come. We ask it all for Jesus' sake. Amen.